Hello, everybody, and welcome to Friends of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. I am your host, Brad Whipple, and this is our series, Bebo's Book Report, which is a podcast series in audio format that has absolutely nothing to do with books, but has everything to do with the television series Star Wars Resistance. Joining me today, as usual, Sarah Haas. Sarah, how is it going today?
Hello, hello. It's going very, very well. Thank you so much for asking.
So happy to still be talking about Star Wars Resistance in the wake of remembering Resistance Day. But Sarah, the conversation doesn't just stop there.
Mm-mm.
And whenever we have an opportunity to continue discussing the show and celebrating it, we will bring that to all of you. And we are so excited to bring you yet another interview in our Remembering Resistance initiative. And this one's definitely special because it is our first with a writer on the show. So, Sarah, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest for our listeners?
Our guest today has done some really exciting work in the past, including writing the 2013 script 1969, A Space Odyssey, or How Kubrick Learned to Stop Worrying and Land on the Moon, which earned her a spot on the blacklist. She has a story by credit on Thor Ragnarok. She was the writer for Toy Story 4, a movie which earned an Academy Award. Upcoming, she is the writer, executive producer, and showrunner for Paper Girls, and as a consulting producer and writer for episodes 1 and 2 of Lord of the Rings. On Star Wars Resistance, she was the writer for season 1 episodes The High Tower and Secrets and Holograms.
So without further ado, let's get right into our interview with screenwriter Stephanie Folsom.
Woody, I know what your problem is.
You do?
You're just like me. Trash!
What is it with you and trash?
It's warm.
Ew.
It's cozy.
I guess.
And safe. Like somebody's whispering in your ear, everything's gonna be okay.
Forky, that's it. That's how Bonnie feels when she's with you.
She does?
Yes!
Wait a second. You mean she thinks I'm warm?
Yep.
And cozy?
Uh-huh.
And sometimes kind of squishy?
Well, that too, yes.
I get it now. I'm Bonnie's trash.
Yes. Wait, what?
I am Bonnie's trash.
No,
oh,
not exactly.
She must be feeling awful without me. Woody, we gotta get going. She needs me.
Yeah.
Hey, Bonnie, I'm coming.
Porky, slow down.
Come on, Woody. Bonnie, I'm coming.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Bebo's Book Report. Sarah and I are back, and we are so, so happy to bring you yet another interview in the wake of Remembering Resistance Day. And on today's episode, we are talking to one of the writers on the show, Stephanie Folsom. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
It's such a pleasure to finally get to talk to one of the writers of the show. And you were on for two of the episodes, at least during season one, Secrets and Holograms and The High Tower, which are both great episodes, just loads of fun around so many different characters. And outside of Star Wars, too, you have just so much amazing work and stuff that you're working on as well. So we're just really excited to get into it. But, you know, first thing I want to ask is, looking back on Star Wars Resistance and your time on that show and kind of seeing how the fans recently were gathering around, remembering the show and getting so excited about it, like, how does it feel to be a part of such a massive property like Star Wars and leave your mark in that universe?
Well, I mean, I grew up, as so many of us did, on the Star Wars films. And so when I got an opportunity to actually like be a part of any little piece of it and be part of like kind of writing just a chunk of the canon, my head kind of exploded. And I think that it goes beyond just a story. I feel like it's almost like Star Wars is kind of our American myth in a weird way. And to be part of like that myth building machine, even though it's just like a tiny little component, season one of like the Resistance, like, I don't know. I'm honored that I got to be a part of it. And it was just such a fun, great group of people to work with. And it really is, I think, a very special show. And I think that we were able to kind of really build out what makes Star Wars so special, which is just really having like the diverse, you know, people involved, making female characters a big part of it. I think Star Wars, because we all love it, at least why I love it, is because it's a story of underdogs. It's about the rebels that can rise up and win. And I think Resistance kind of captured that in a really beautiful way.
So kind of going back, I mean, I have to agree, I find that community is one of the best things to come out of Resistance, and we'll probably dive into more about that later, but I could talk about it all day. But I guess kind of going back with your personal history of Star Wars, did it play a role in your life growing up? And if so, you know, how did it affect you and what you wanted to do?
Well, I think, I mean, growing up, there weren't that many strong female characters I could really look up to. I feel like I would always have to graft myself onto like the boy character, and seeing Princess Leia like blew my mind because it wasn't like a princess I had ever seen before. Like she was firing weapons and talking sassy and being tough. And I think that was kind of like my way into the Star Wars universe, actually seeing a character that was a wish fulfillment for me that actually was a woman.
Yeah.
I think kind of like my way in. And then I just kind of fell in love with the entire universe. I think that George Lucas did something amazing, obviously. I mean, that's kind of like a no dust statement, like, but I think, you know, I just think that there's something amazing about those stories that strike a chord with us, you know, especially in these times.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the biggest things with Resistance in particular, that it was such a, it's kind of crazy to think it actually ended this year with how many things we've been through as a world and a society. But Resistance kind of, to me, stands out as one of those glaring bright spots from the year where I like last felt kind of happy. And it might sound a little depressing to say that, but it's also really uplifting in a way that say, like, you know, this is all just temporary and we have things like Resistance to bring us joy and bring us happiness. And I think that's what the show is all about, you know. Leading up to the point where you're actually working on Star Wars, you've been doing so much before that. And what has it been like kind of navigating your screenwriting career? And I know in particular in 2013, your script for 1969, A Space Odyssey was on the blacklist, and that kind of helped launch you as well. So what was it like navigating all that to get to where you are today?
Well, I think that... you know, 1969 kind of like launched me, my career, and got me the meetings, which led to bigger jobs. And somehow I don't know how I did it, I stumbled into these big franchises. And I think it's because like my writing, at least I like to think so, is really rooted in character and fundamental emotions and relationships. So I think that I just stumbled into like these big universes. I like to think that I bring kind of like a personal character, emotional through line to them. And I try to really figure out like what makes that franchise tick and enhance it in ways that make the fans happy, but surprise you as well. And I think that level of surprise comes from finding the emotional truth in those characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely relate to that as a consumer of many of these major franchises and somebody who loves to read books and, you know, see movies and things, that like I really connect when I have a character to dive into and that I can understand their emotions. And even in a journey that I didn't expect them to take throughout Toy Story 4, I was like, I don't know, this is interesting that we're doing another one of these. And then I was totally on board because it was totally different and really exciting. And I'm curious about what it's like kind of finding these characters and kind of coming up with concepts and actually doing the process of writing.
Well, I think I think like my initial meetings in these projects is always bizarre because I think my reaction is the same as everyone else's, where I go in and I'm just like, I love this franchise, but why are you doing another one? Like, I felt that way with Toy Story. I did a draft with Thor Ragnarok and I was like, why are you making another Thor movie? So I probably need to work on my pitch there. But but I think leading with that question kind of steers the conversation and where the movie needs to go in the right place. Mm. Because I think, especially now, like, why is this story important? Why are we going to tell it? What needs to be brought forward? What's the point in doing all of this? Because you're going to be, these studios are spending so much money. People are spending so much time. I mean, with Toy Story, animation takes a while. That was 2+ years of my life working on that. it has to be worth it. So what are we saying? What are we doing? Why are we telling this story? I think are the key, you know, questions you need to ask going into any of these stories. And yeah, no, I probably should not walk into job interviews and being like, why are you having this job?
See, I think your attitude towards the screenwriting process is what we need more of that focus on the emotional attachment with characters. And looking at when you were at the Santa Barbara Film Festival earlier this year, the type of panel you were on, right? Because you had like Greta Gerwig, Lulu Wang, Noah Harpster, Christopher Marcus. I mean, those are all people that were creating films that were so character-centric with such dynamic characters and people that we could really attach ourselves to. And it makes sense. Like, everybody kind of had that mentality. So, and I love the fact that during that panel, you kind of talked about, I think you referred to your process as a wackadoodle process, which I thought was a great way to phrase it. But really, you talked about the emotional gold and the beautiful character moments all within this kind of visually stunning narrative as well. When you finally get to Star Wars Resistance, what does that creative process look like now that you're working within this world that has been established for so long, but also you're in a sandbox and you start to get to create these sorts of new stories?
Well, I mean, that was such a fun sandbox playing because we had so many toys, even more than Toy Story. So, I mean, I think an important distinction to make is that, you know, the feature writing process is different than doing a TV show. And Brandon Allman, the showrunner of Star Wars Resistance, brought together myself and five other people with Filoni, and we kind of sat down in a room at Skywalker Ranch, which was just, I mean, I was having trouble paying attention the first day because I was just like a little giggly kid, and I was like, guys, we're at Skywalker Ranch. Like, yeah, we know, it's okay.
That's the correct reaction, though. You're okay.
So once I got my act together and attempted to play it cool, and we were just diving into the story, Brandon had kind of Filoni had an idea of like how they wanted the story to kind of go. I mean, it really was just like taking these pilots, you know, kind of a do the right stuff kind of thing, at the edge of the known universe, and kind of being the first show to really introduce the new order. Which was kind of that immediately. I was just like, wait, we get to introduce the new order in this one? They're like, yeah. That's so cool. So pretty much my entire writing experience in that room was just like, that's so cool. and I think also it's like we had Pablo there, who was like such a wealth of knowledge and just knew so much. And so I had the fun job of once again, I'm like more of the emotional core person. So when it came to like knowing all the, I mean, I know like my X-Wings and you know, all that kind of stuff. But when it came to like the nitty gritty detail of what these ships were like and all that, like Pablo was like an amazing resource. So that was just fun to like pick his brain on like how these ships could work, what they looked like, how each character would have their own ship. Just fun stuff like that was what we really dug into. And then of course, just like the fantastic relationship they have. I mean, poor Kaz, you know, has to show up there. He's got this crap job and he can't let anyone know who he is. And I mean, that's that dichotomy with him and the other people there. And then also, it's just, I feel like what was so great about Resistance is that everyone had these secrets, I think, for a good part of season one, that kept them from realizing that they all had more in common than they ever realized. And that if they could just have an honest conversation with each other and the world didn't get in the way, like they could have been one big happy family right away. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just playing with those dynamics and kind of like those friend and family relationships was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think in the episode, The High Tower, it kind of, the title itself explains the way in which the ship kind of works. And you're kind of writing about class and this level theory and these perceptions of people that are far away from us or seem far away from us. And what's it kind of like to navigate these complicated ideas and these ideas that are a lot larger than what you typically expect a kids show or a show aimed at children to be discussing? And what's it like to kind of navigate that and balance its audience?
Well, I mean, I think the fun part is that we would play a little game of like how much we could get away with. because I mean, my personal theory, when you're telling a story for kids, they shouldn't be for kids. They should be for everyone, because I don't think kids get to learn about the world if they don't understand how it works and see some real darkness. And I mean, I don't want to traumatize any children, even though I probably did with some of the stuff in Toy Story 4. that I think that, approaching, real darkness and real human struggle in an environment that's safe helps kids be prepared to really deal with the world. And so I think it's our job as storytellers to really push things as far as we can without doing harm. You know, I mean, now and then a Disney executive would be like, "You can't do that." And we're like, all right. But for the most part, they let us really dive into complex issues. You know, I mean, the class issues that you're talking about were all done on purpose. But, you know, we did it for fun. There was chase sequences. There was hiding in closets. Like, you're laughing, even though underneath it all, it really is like an upstairs, downstairs kind of story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talking about how these stories can affect the way in which children perceive the world, and you don't just write it for kids, you write it for everybody. What do you see as the importance of these stories in like a child's upbringing, and even for like adults? Like what do you see as the importance of us connecting to a story like Star Wars, and how we can, or even in some of the other stories that you've written as well, like how that really affects us profoundly? You know, it's not just a movie, even though many people will say, you know, it's just a set of movies. Why do you care so much? Like, from your perspective and your relationship with Star Wars, like, it's so much more than that, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit of a story zealot, so I'm going to be completely biased in everything that I'm saying here. But I do believe that stories allow us to play in worlds where we can find our way. As a culture, as a society, as human beings in our relationships, it gives us a safe playground to work these things out so that we can bring these stories back to our daily life and either be like, no, like, you know, I'm not going to be a serial killer like Silence of the Lambs. I saw that was awful. I'm going to be Clarice and fight it. You know, I don't talk about Silence of the Lambs right now, but you get my point. I think that stories give us a safe playground to work out things. I mean, it even gives us a safe playground to test out technology. I mean, Star Trek is an example of that. Like, the iPhone came from, I mean, the iPhone designers even admit it came from the communication devices on that, you know. Stories give us a way to paint possibilities and to choose new directions. And they also bring us a way to come together because they build empathy. You know, mm-hmm. I may not be in a situation where I can see people from different walks of life or know what's going on in other parts of the world, or in this case, other parts of the universe and galaxy. But by witnessing that experience and going on an emotional journey with them, I can have more empathy for experiences outside my own. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think stories are so important. You know, we're telling a way forward for humanity. To get grandiose about the whole thing.
Yeah, and empathy is something that often nowadays it feels like so many people kind of lack, and storytelling is really important for developing those emotions. You're so right. Even something like a Harry Potter, for instance, right? It's all these like very in-group, out-group sort of dynamics, and really like just seeing perspectives, like you said, that you haven't already seen. And something with Star Wars Resistance and the episodes that you wrote is there are such complicated relationships that are portrayed. You know, you have Niku, who's always kind of very innocent but trying his best at all points in time, and then you have Tam, who really wants to be up to the level of an ace, but she's not quite there yet, and she sees Kaz kind of rising faster than she is, and then you have Tora, who in Secrets and Holograms she feels very coddled by her father, and she wants to sort of have this freedom that she doesn't necessarily attain just yet. So there's this rebellious spirit within her. how do you approach writing these characters, especially characters that aren't necessarily established, they're brand new with the series, and finding their voice, also knowing who, which actors that you're working with that will portray those characters?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, like digging into characters that you don't know is kind of figuring out who they think they are, who the world thinks they are, and who they want to be, and kind of how that all melds together to kind of create their personality and create their successes and the problems that they have in life. I mean, I think characters, which was so great about Resistance, like I was saying earlier, is like they all have secrets, you know? And I think whatever that secret is, whether it's something as silly as just being like, you know, I feel too confined by my father and, you know, I don't want people to know that I'm spoiled, you know? I mean, that seems like such a mundane secret, but I think the weight of that is carried in the character, and she, that means the world to her. And if we make us care about her, it's going to mean the world to us as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we talk about Resistance with many of the, you know, cast members we've spoken with, there's often a discussion of the representation both within the cast of characters and the actors that portray them. But that's not the only kind of representation that we see in this episode or in this show. You are the first woman in the room writing for this series. And does that position have meaning for you? And what's it often like navigating an industry that is dominated often by men?
Well, unfortunately, I usually am the only woman in the room. I think it's a genre problem. But I see that changing, and that makes me very, very happy. Because lately, the things I've been working on, and even the TV show that I'm show running, the percentages are inversed. We have a couple of guys, and it's all women. I think it's important to have many voices in there, and more than just one as well, because I'm glad that I was able to be that female voice in the room. But I mean, I'm kind of an oddball chick, you know, I'm kind of nerdy, I'm kind of weird. I do not want to be the voice of my gender. We need to get a full spectrum in there. Mm-hmm. There are so many voices that need to be heard. So yes, I'm grateful that I'm able to be the female voice in the room, but I want more, and I want more of every kind of voice in there, because it's just going to make better stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. And there were other women writers in season two, and that's also great to see, with Jennifer Corbett among those. And I know she's doing other things at Lucasfilm as well, which is exciting. I fully agree, and I'm looking forward to your work with Paper Girls and to see that all come together.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm excited about that one too. And I think we were very lucky. Like Brandon, it was very important for him to have those voices in the room, and he made it happen. And that's important to have leadership that wants that.
How is the Star Wars Resistance experience just so unlike anything else that you had worked on prior? Because I mean, you talk about obviously going to Skywalker Ranch, which is a big deal, but is there anything that you really took away from this project that added to your perception of the screenwriting process, or maybe changed some of the ways that you go about it, or even just like heightened your appreciation for the types of storytelling that we can put out into the world?
Well, I mean, I think that I think when you're dealing with something that has such canon, I mean, I the best way I can explain it is that I'm going to go off on a tangent here, so bear with me. The best way I can explain it is that a lot of the franchises that you're dealing with and the canon you're dealing with, those, they have reset buttons kind of built into them story-wise. Like Marvel Universe has time travel. Star Trek has time travel. Star Wars is a continuous linear timeline. There is no reset button. Whatever is written in it stays in it. Which is extremely intimidating, but also unbelievably exciting. And I think being forced to work within those constraints was actually kind of wonderful, because I think you know, being like, what's the new and exciting thing you can do given all of this written in stone that came before and everything that came after? You know, what can you do with this piece that, you know, of this timeline, you know, that makes it all flow lovely, but is unique and wonderful? And at first that terrified me, but then once we got into it, it was kind of wonderful, because there's something wonderful about realizing that there is a very concrete made up world behind all of it, and having that wealth of just backstory and world building around you is pretty great.
It's very interesting to see the story continue, and how when Disney purchased Lucasfilm and they said, okay, everything, all these stories are kind of no longer canon, but we're kind of doing this new thing. And we're in the middle of that, you know, right now. And we're probably in the very beginnings of that, if we really think about it, with many more years of Star Wars storytelling to come. It's so interesting to see how everybody kind of carves out that space and uses the world that has already existed to expand upon that. And kind of pivoting a little bit, during the Santa Barbara film panel, which I rewatched the other night, but I mean, I was in the room and just like frantically writing notes. But Christopher Marcus, writer of Infinity War, mentioned the value of a happy ending, and you know, saying that there's a lot of value in it, and it's essential, and people need it. People are desperate for that. And within the context of Resistance, there is that happy ending at the very end. They all come together. They finally move past their secrets and come together as a community, all accepting one another and in the fight together. Do you find a lot of value in the happy ending? And, you know, is this something we should be promoting, especially as the world seems to be so complicated and dire?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously a big fan of the happy ending. I think the key is having an emotionally satisfying ending. Speaking to Toy Story 4, there was tons of pushback about Woody leaving. Spoilers for Toy Story 4. If anyone hasn't seen it, I'm about to ruin it for you. Woody leaving with Bo Peep. You know, I mean, that was seen as a tragedy, and it was seen as a tragedy by a lot of the fans too, but it was emotionally satisfying and it fulfilled the arc. And to me, what on the surface can seem like a sad ending, if it emotionally fulfills everything that your character has been through, then it's a happy ending. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're looking for. I think in our endings, I think it's important to have emotional honesty and some kind of truth in it, because if you don't nail that, you're wondering why you wasted all this time watching it. You know, I mean, we want to feel like something was gained at the end of the journey. And I think that's what we kind of hope for in our lives. We hope that there's something hopeful that we get out of the struggle.
Yeah. You're speaking right to George Lucas's vision of Star Wars. He's always been such a huge promoter of, this should be spiritually uplifting. You should leave the movie theater and be like the happiest, joyous you've ever been in your entire life. Like, that's how I want these movies to make you feel. Nobody wants to go watch the main character die. And, you know, I don't want to go watch Woody get incinerated in Toy Story 3. That would have been horrible. I'm really glad you bring up Toy Story 4, because it is kind of a complex ending when you look at it, but it is truly, I think, a satisfying ending, because when you were on the panel talking about, it was kind of blowing my mind as you were going through the process of how Woody leaving that room and experiencing the sort of freedom that he never had, for him to go back to that room, Andy's room, that's actually more of a tragic ending for Woody, because how can you experience all of this and see Bo Peep and let her go once again, you know? But for him, it's like, you can help more children than just Andy now. And that's really encapsulated in the very end with, was it Dolly? I forget her. I'm blanking on her name right now. The main villainous doll. Yeah. Gabby, yes.
Oh no, she scares me.
Because they help Gabby. And I'm like, I would totally love to see more of these two characters helping other toys find their kid, you know? And that's that is that emotionally uplifting ending. And I love that so much. And I hadn't thought of it. When you're heading into Toy Story 4, you're wondering, how can it top Toy Story 3? But for me, it almost does in some ways, because Woody gets his full character arc to be completed.
Yeah, and I think that's the key, because I mean, I think, you know, I think especially right now we need happy endings, because the reality is super rough. That doesn't mean that there's not room for stories that end horribly too. I think we need those as well. But
it's a balance, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But my personal preference is, I don't know, there's enough yuck we have to deal with in reality. Like, let's bring a little bit more joy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when you're approaching a film like Toy Story 4, knowing, you know, and again with Star Wars, knowing that there's a lot that comes before it and a lot of expectations that people have about these franchises and you know, like a lot of attachment that it has to, you know, their childhood or just how they make meaning in the world. What's it like approaching a property like this and deciding how you're going to differentiate it from the things that came before?
Well, I think, like, my initial question, like, why is the story being told? You know, why does this need to happen? And also, I think just, you know, is there a way that I can bring my experience in the world and what I do as a writer to enhance what is going to be here? And if the answer is no, then I don't do it. But if the answer is yes, that I can bring something from my experience, you know, to the story that will make it better, then that's helpful. And that's something that can really move it forward and move the mythology forward.
Yeah. And I think for Toy Story 4, moving that mythology forward was Bo Peep especially. And I love how in the Santa Barbara panel, you described them as military commanders. So like, Woody was the military commander of Andy's room, and then Bo Peep was of Molly's room. And I was like, that's awesome. I love that so much. And I think for me, that was the huge pull for that film. Like you said earlier, you know, early in your screenwriting career, you didn't see a lot of like strong female characters that were being written in many of these properties. Now Bo Peep is kind of that next iteration. I think a lot of the ways in which Bo Peep was marketed for the film kind of felt almost like a Rey in a way, and just that she was going to be the focal point of this film. And it was so great to see her back. So did you really see that as kind of the biggest way to truly advance this story? And do you think it would have worked without Bo Peep?
There were discussions about it working without Bo Peep, but I fought very hard to make sure that was there, because I think that was kind of the spine of the story, was their relationship. And there was no, to me, like, why tell this movie? And telling that movie was to actually explore, like, who Bo Peep was, who she was in this room, why she was so important to Woody. Like, those are questions I wanted answers to. And I'm glad to see I wasn't the only one. People seem to be responding to it well, you know? And I kind of feel like that's kind of something that I've always carried with me. I feel like I didn't get representation I wanted to see in stories growing up, you know. I was the girl that wanted to go on adventures. I was the girl that wanted to, you know, save the day, you know, not in real life, but, you know, just as, you know, as fun, you know. I kept getting all these stories growing up about how, you know, I had to look pretty for a party or get a makeover or win over the boy. And there's nothing wrong with those stories, but that just wasn't the type of person I was. So I think, you know, I want to be able to have, like, young girls, you know, have a story that they can actually put themselves in and make themselves a hero. Because sadly, I don't think we've had that much in our films and TV.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to also have a multitude of stories, because you said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the makeover, the coming of age story in that format or that way that we are typically used to seeing, but it's not the only way to be a girl, or it's not the only girl that we should be seeing ourselves in or that should be represented. So it's really exciting to get characters like Leia and like Bo Peep, and I like Wonder Woman when that movie came out, and I just like cried a lot because, you know, I love Captain America. Captain America's really cool. But I don't see myself necessarily in Captain America. So, but also to have like stories about complicated women. You know, Tam in Resistance, she's complicated, and she really has a story that is about wanting to be seen. And so I think that this is all valid and also important in our storytelling.
Well, and also I think that there's a tendency with female characters to not allow them to go to dark places. And I think that we need to see that, because how can we every human being goes to a dark place every now and then. That's just the nature of being alive. And how are we going to know that's okay and we can get through it if we don't see it somewhere in our storytelling?
You are speaking like poetry to our ears right now. I could speak for Sarah and I in that statement. Thinking of Star Wars in general, that's why we love Rey, and especially in The Last Jedi, because we thought, Sarah and I think in The Last Jedi, she especially went to a very dark place, quite literally, you know, going down in the depths of this cave and not necessarily getting the answers that she wanted and showing some vulnerability with her. And it's like kind of okay to have these messy, complicated characters, because like you said, that's how we all are, right? We're messy and complicated, and that's how we live our lives. And that's, I think that's when we see ourselves even more in these characters, when they're like, all right, every character is not perfect. They're fallible. They can mess up. They can make mistakes. And I think we definitely see that again in Resistance, with so many secrets being held. Secrecy is the bane of existence in the Star Wars universe, and it leads to all of the problems, you know? So it's like embrace these things that make us vulnerable and weak, and put them out there and don't hide them, you know, because I think that's something as a society that we're often told to do is hide the things that make us weak and don't show vulnerability. And the more we show that on screen, the more we get comfortable with it in ourselves.
Well, 100%, I couldn't agree more. And also, it just makes for better storytelling.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's why I find a villain like Kylo Ren so interesting, is because, especially again, in The Last Jedi, I guess. It's the Last Jedi episode now, sorry. you know.
Totally fine.
You know, he smashes the mask, and you see a whole nother layer to some of his troubles. And you kind of get to understand him a little bit better when you get to see how vulnerable his face becomes when he's being, you know, taunted by Snoke. But yeah.
No, I like that too. No, and I was very impressed with what Rian Johnson did. I think he brought a level of complexity to those, and darkness to those characters, that was really beautiful.
Now, speaking of writing messy characters, so you thought of Toy Story 4, the thesis sort of being, who do you become when the world throws you out? And I love that so much. And when the world throws you out, my mind immediately goes to Forky. Because Forky, let me tell you, one of the icons of our generation, so great. Like, Toy Story 4, it was just so funny having him be kind of this character that makes you think, what does it mean to be a toy? And it was the first character, when I saw the trailers, I was like, we're going to have like an identity crisis in a Toy Story film. For many of us, we grew up with these films. You know, we saw Toy Story in the 90s when they were coming out, and now we're adults and we're going through our own crisis. So when you talk about these animated projects not just being written for kids, it's written for everybody. And the adults in the theater are like, I'm going through what Forky's going through too. That's me. So it speaks to every age group. And I think that's what is so unique about him. But what was it like in the writer's room developing and crafting that character who is so messy and like doesn't really understand his place in the world? You know, like, am I a toy? It's just so great and wonderful, but speaks to something larger.
Well, when I came on board, Forky was a one-off joke. Like, Bonnie had just created his own character, and then they cracked a joke about like how Bonnie was God, and then they threw it out, and it was a funny joke, but it was also just like, you know, we can't establish Bonnie as God of the toys in the movie. That was just a farce. And so it was kind of, I think they were debating whether or not it should even be, that scene should even be in the movie. And the whole movie, I mean, Woody is going through an existential crisis. Like, who am I? What's my purpose in the world? And so is Bo too, as well, where it's very much, as you said, like, who am I now that I'm thrown out in the world, says I'm trash? How do I define myself? And it was kind of just like sitting there like a gold mine that Forky could be the voice of what is like this internal struggle in every single character in that movie. and it could be done in a really funny, great way. And then once we started going down that road with Forky, it became not making him monstrous, because some of the early animation was just, Forky was not cute. Forky was just like, I'm trash. And you're like, yes, you are. Please go. Okay, you are scary. And I think Andrew and I were sitting in the conference room at Pixar, trying to figure out a scene with Forky, and when he first comes out and is introduced to the room, and don't tell anyone at Pixar, but we had snuck in Andrew's puppy. They don't allow dogs on the campus. We snuck in his puppy, and so we were like trying to like hide the puppy while we're trying to figure out this scene. And then his puppy kind of like came out from under the table and like looked around the same way that Forky does in the movie, and we were just like, oh, Forky's a puppy. Like, and so that kind of like opened it up in a way that like all of his behavior, I think he becomes a little bit more childlike as he figures out the world, but when you first meet him, he literally is like, you bring home a puppy and it's just like, who are you people? What is going on? I don't want to come out of my kennel. I'm going to poop on the floor like that.
We're getting a dog this weekend at my family. You're reminding me of all these things we're about to go through all over again.
Yeah, you got a little Forky on your hand.
Yeah. We'll spin it to the positive.
And you're like, you're not trash. You're an adorable dog. Stop it.
Yes.
Toy Story 4, I think, though, is unique in that respect, and kind of just the question of like, who am I and what is my place in the world? And that is a lot of what we go through in our whole lives. We're always trying to define who we are. And I think that's why the story is so beautifully told, because like you said, every character goes through that. And how do you hope that the film is remembered? And how do you really think it kind of defines the overall, or what does it add to the overall like Toy Story mythology?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't think I have any like grandiose expectations. I think anytime I'm taking on one of these things, I mean, my only thought is like, oh, thank goodness I didn't screw it up. So in a weird way, I think, you know, I'm so happy that what we did connected with people, and that the intention that we were trying to get across and try to communicate was received and people got it. Because I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's just a bunch of people in a room making things up and trying to communicate and entertain as much as possible. But at the end of the day, you know, the audience experience is totally outside your control. So you just hope that you've done the work so that people enjoy it and connect with it and feel something. And if that happens, I'm just like, oh, mission accomplished. Good. I didn't ruin childhoods. Yes.
Success. People like it. They're not sad.
Exactly. And I think if I even just being in like the weeds of these things, tried to, I don't think I'd be able to do my job if I thought about like the real cultural impact it had or the impact it had on people's lives. I think I would just be a deer in headlights and just probably never get out of bed, because that seems like such a huge mountain to climb.
And it really frames the idea of like, oh, this is more than human or less than human. And I have to, you know, aspire to these unhuman like standards. And yeah, that's crushing. So, you know, you're not only writing, you mentioned it much earlier in the episode, but you've done some producing work in the past, and you're writing and executive producing and show running Paper Girls for Amazon Prime. I believe that's where it's going to be at. And what's it been like to take on this new role or this role within this project?
Well, I mean, I really like doing the producing aspect of it as well, because you know, it's about having to have more, have your fingers in more aspects of what's going on with it. And I think it's kind of a way of like, because you write the vision of how it should be, It's only a piece of paper and it has to go through all these levels of interpretation before it ends up on the screen. And I think producing gives you a way to communicate to, you know, everyone involved in the process what the intention is on the page. Mm. And I find that really great and really helpful. And so far, the people I'm working with find it really helpful as well, because this is a collaborative team effort. And the script really only is a blueprint for what's going to end up on the screen. And so how do we make this the best blueprint possible so that the heart and soul of what this was originally intended to be makes it through, you know, casting, it makes it through, you know, the directing of it, it makes it through the editing, you know, there's all these stages where, you know, a visual story could go off the rails. And I think that's why if we see something that is kind of going on all thrusters, it feels so good, because I think part of us knows it took a team of hundreds and hundreds of people working together to accomplish one vision. And I think being able to have a voice in that vision has been really wonderful. I mean, plus I love working with all these departments. I love working with creative people. So I think it's a great just expansion of just being able to like do the writing and then being able to work with everyone on it.
Mm-hmm. And some of your other projects that are coming up. So I'm a huge Tolkien head, like hardcore. It's like my other fandom outside of Star Wars. And to see that you'll be a consulting producer and writing I believe the first two episodes. So what has it been like to step now into the maybe like arguably the next biggest universe outside of Star Wars, at least in my opinion, and something where you could also maybe scratch your head and go, why do we need more? But like, there's so much canon there to explore and to bring to the screen. Like, what has it been like to be a part of that? To whatever you can speak to.
Oh, completely. I mean, I can't tell you plot details because I'm pretty sure that you
have completely. Yeah, tell me everything.
Like, suddenly, like, this connection would just go dead. But I mean, I'm a big Tolkien head as well. Like, I read Lord of the Rings, I think, when I was about 12 for the first time, and it blew my mind. I mean, God, this is how much of a dork I was. I mean, other kids my age had, like, you know, the boy band posters up and all that. And I literally had a poster that had all a map of Middle Earth and where all the civilizations lived spelled out. So I was that cool. And so...
I mean, I have a Star Wars poster and Sarah's got a Star Trek poster behind her. So I think you're in good company here.
I'm with my people. I'd worked with the guys who are showrunning Lord of the Rings on some other franchises we'd done some work on with them. And, you know, they said, hey, we're doing Lord of the Rings. And I was like, I love Lord of the Rings. Why? And this used to be every, I'm like, those movies were perfect. Why mess with it? And they're like, well, this is what we're going to do, and it's the second age. I can say that because it's been announced. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm. I leaned forward and I was like, tell me more. And they did, and I was like, that has the potential to be a really cool story. All right, I'm in.
Yeah, I'm anxiously waiting. And you know, Amazon has a really great track record of putting out some pretty incredible stuff, and it's just great to see you not only bringing all of your previous experience to this universe now, but going alongside this extremely talented, diverse group of people behind the scenes. And I'm just really looking forward to what's to come.
Yeah, no, I mean, with COVID of it all and everything, you know, like the shooting's been a little all over the place, but like, I'm excited to see like what we start coming back with on stuff. Right? So I don't know. I think, we'll see, but I have high hopes for that I feel like they keyed into some really cool character stuff with it. So
yeah. Cool.
But then again, you know, you never know. I'm like, as long as people like it and say we didn't mess it up, good.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to it. And is there anything that, other than those two projects or including those two projects, that we should be on the lookout for you? I know that the industry is definitely in a weird spot, especially because of COVID and just what the way our world looks like right now. Anything that we should keep our eyes out for?
I think I'm working on stuff I can't talk about right now. It's an odd job because it's like I work, it's like I'm a spy with information that really has no stakes. So I mean, very often I'm like at family dinners and like, Stephanie, what are you working on? And I'm like, I can't talk about it.
I'm an accountant.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not here. I just...
Nobody asks what you do when you say you're an accountant. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep it a secret. It's like NDA left and right. It's fine.
Sometimes I'll say English teacher because I feel like I can kind of fake that one. And sadly, nobody cares about that profession either.
Much love to the English teachers of the world.
Exactly.
They're doing good stuff. But I mean, we'll definitely keep our eyes out for exciting announcements and just for the continuation of both Paper Girls and Lord of the Rings. I'm very looking forward to both of those things, especially as a reader of Brian K. Vaughan's work. I'm a huge fan of Saga, so.
No, I mean Brian's amazing. He's been amazing to work with. I mean, that was another thing too, where I was just like I fell in love with Saga and I fell in love with Paper Girls and I made it my mission to meet Brian K. Vaughan. And then I met him and I was like, I'm gonna make you be my friend. Some, stalker mission accomplished.
Well, Stephanie, we would love to wrap up with a couple, just three real quick questions to send us off, but my first one for you is, in the realm of Star Wars, what is your favorite Star Wars film that really speaks to you the most?
Well, I mean, I want to say Empire Strikes Back because I adore that movie and I know that's like the popular cliche choice. But I love Return of the
It's a great
Murder
movie.
Bears.
And I'm not going to apologize for loving the Ewoks,
Ewoks.
I'm a fan.
I have a Ewok on a keychain. His name is Paul, and like he's my best buddy. Like I take him everywhere on my bag with me. So the Ewoks are great. I mean, you can't
Yeah, I
say.
mean, you talk about Star Wars being an underdog story. The Ewoks are the most underdog of them all.
Absolutely. And I also kind of love the fact that they're cannibals. I mean, well, not cannibals, I couldn't say. They don't eat each other, but they eat humans. I mean,
Yeah, we definitely overlook the stormtrooper helmet on the spit at the end of the movie, like all the time.
No, I mean, they're awful, but so adorable. And I love that. I love the fact that they're vicious warriors that you just want to pinch their cheeks.
They have layers. They're very
They're so
complex.
complex.
So I guess the other question we have is, what is your best writing or screenwriting tip you'd give to somebody who is hoping to become a writer in some capacity?
I would say writing is a constant process, and rewriting and rewriting is just part of that process. Don't expect like your first draft to be brilliant. Nobody's first draft is brilliant. You just don't show anyone it. So I think perfectionism, because I feel like that's just kind of expected because I just know talking to a lot of people, a lot of writers that I'm mentoring as well, that they read the final drafts of these screenplays and expect to live up to that. And I'm like, that was like 20 or 30 drafts in. So give yourself the latitude to not be good until the point that you do get good. And that just becomes going at it again and again. It's kind of like playing a piano or playing any instrument if you've ever played an instrument. I obviously play piano, but at first you gotta just figure out where to put your fingers on the keys and learn how to read music. And it takes a while until you're actually playing music. And the same is for screenwriting. It's a craft. You gotta practice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just continuing to stare at that page no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. Even though
Yeah.
it's killing you on the inside.
Me as a piano player slash singer going, I don't know what this dissonance looks like or like sounds like. You're like, this rhythm, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. it's okay to be lost. Keep doing it, you'll find your way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And our last question to kind of sum up everything for you in the Star Wars universe, what does Star Wars mean to you at the end of the day?
I think Star Wars means to me at the end of the day a story that, you know, very often horrible circumstances fall into your lap and you don't have to be from a certain walk of life or be gifted with a certain skill set in order to rise above them and be a hero. And I find that that's the beauty of the Star Wars universe. I think you're so often, I mean, it begins with Luke and it carries on to Rey and it goes through the entire core of the series that they had bad things happen to them, invading forces came in, you know, life's got upended and they never asked for it, they never expected it, but they rose to the occasion. And I think that's kind of a beautiful lesson that we can get away from it all. You don't have to have superpowers in order to be a hero.
I love that. It's Broom Boy looking up at the sky at the end of Last Jedi. It's so poetic, and I love that answer. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. It's so wonderful to have you. Where can people find you online, on your social media or your website?
I feel awful because I'm very spotty about checking social media, but you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. I have a website that I'm horrible about updating, but wait a second, right? So if you want someone that posts like every 3 or 4 weeks, I'm your person to follow.
Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you for your time and may the Force be with you.
May the Force be also with you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to our interview with Stephanie. If there's one thing I learned from this is that I love Forky even more than I ever have. Could you agree with that, Sarah?
I mean, that's really fantastic for you because I know that you loved Forky pretty much to the moon and back before, but maybe it's to the sun and back now. That's very impressive.
But in all seriousness, you know, we are just so thankful to have had the opportunity to speak with Stephanie and learn more about her writing process and her career and also just what the power of storytelling means to her. So again, thank you all for listening. So Sarah, as we send off this episode of Bebo's Book Report, where can our listeners find you online?
You can find me at SCH221 on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Goodreads. And you can find my BookTube-ish channel, Sarah Vlogs Thoughts, over on YouTube.
Excellent. And as for me, I'm trash. And you can find me at Brad Whipple and at Friends of the Force on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can also join our Patreon at patreon.com/friendsoftheforce, where we have some pretty big changes coming up. Thank you to our current patrons, Amy, Anna, Cheryl, Deborah, Donnie, Elegy, Marie Claire, our newest patron, Marvin. Hey, Marvin. Neil, Rachel, Sarah, and T. So once again, thank you all for supporting the show. Leave a 5-star review and rating wherever you listen to the podcast. And that is all for this week. Until next time, everybody. Sarah, thank you. We are ones with the Force. We are friends of the Force. And may the Force be with you always.
Bye.
Friends of the Force is a proud member of the Star Wars Escape Pods Network. To learn more about our sister shows, find us on Twitter at @WeAreEscapePods. The Star Wars Escape Pods Network, promoting positivity in fandom.
This is Forky.
I'm Trash.